This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In 1969, the Salvadoran army launched an attack on neighboring Honduras. It was not a land grab or ideological conflict that led to the attack. It was a dispute over a soccer match. As one journalist noted at the time, in Latin America, the border between soccer and politics is vague. A new book explores the role of soccer or football in Latin America and how it helped shape national identity in a neo-colonial world. Joshua Nadel is the author of Football, F-U-T-B-O-L, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America. He's also a professor of Latin American and Caribbean History at North Carolina Central University, and he joins us now. Joshua, good to have you on the State of Things.
Thanks for having me.
You point out in the book that soccer came to Latin America in the 1860s. How did it get there, and what was the political climate?
Sure. First of all, soccer arrives in Latin America sort of in the bags of Englishmen generally, but also sometimes Scottish, basically people from the United Kingdom. And the political climate at the time was really one of admiration for all things British and all things European to a large extent. So, for instance, Latin American elites sought to have their nations look like Europe physically. They redesigned cities to make them look more like Paris or London. They also wanted the country to look more like Latin America physically. So this was a period of time where there was a lot of recruitment of Europeans to come over to Latin America in efforts to sort of quote unquote whiten the nation. Mm.
What did it look like ethnically at that time when this effort was going on?
Sure, I think that generally speaking, Latin America is a mixture of three different sort of, let's say, racial roots. You could say there's the indigenous population that was there when the Europeans arrived. There were Africans that were brought over as slaves, and also obviously Europeans. And that's sort of the triracinated nature of Latin American society.
We think about this now as the soccer as the everyman sport. So then when I read your book and realized that this was really an elite sport of
Sure.
Europeans at the time, right?
It was an elite sport for the Europeans who came over to Latin America, who tended to be sort of from the middle classes in England. And in the actual elite sport in England at the time, you would say it was cricket. But when people came over to Latin America, soccer became the dominant sport very quickly in both elite, the expatriate athletic clubs, and then also among the elite Latin Americans.
Now, was it just a recreational activity? Was it playing a role in national identity?
It played a major role in the construction of national identities within the region. In Argentina and Uruguay and Brazil, really it played a major role in incorporating sort of massive waves of immigrants that came over from Europe, predominantly Spain and Italy in the case of Argentina and Uruguay, and Portugal and Italy in the case of Brazil. And also in Brazil, it played a big role in sort of bringing in people of African descent as well. So the nations were sort of grappling with who is going to be considered a citizen in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And soccer played a major role in allowing people of sort of different ethnic groups to come into the nation and be accepted, non-elites to be accepted as part of the nation.
Well, you're talking about this impulse in the middle of the 19th century to sort of Europeanize mm-hmm. Latin America. Then why would there be an impulse to create also a multicultural society? Is that
sure.
the same thing?
So it stems, I think, from by the turn of the 20th century, really, there's a subtle shift within Latin American thinking towards looking for internal roots for pride and internal roots for national heritage instead of looking to Europe. I think there's still quite a bit of European influence within those views. But there is this look to, okay, it starts around 1900, to look at, the indigenous roots of Latin America. And a little bit later in the 1920s and 1930s to look at really the African influence in Latin America as well.
How does it evolve from this elite sort of European sport, mm-hmm. at least in Latin America, to an everyman more multicultural?
According to sort of the dominant narrative of the of the sport in the region, sort of there are non-elites who watch the elite clubs playing. So kids in the street see the elite people in Buenos Aires playing, and they sort of figure that they can play the game as well, that they can, you know, they can find a ball or they can stuff a sock. Or, I mean, this is the sort of the dominant history of this. And then they can ultimately, they believe, or at least the story goes, that they then will take on the elite and defeat the elites at their game. And this really gives soccer, imbues soccer with a lot of power for the working classes, right? It's a way that they can show that they're equal to the company managers or the governing and business elites.
Is this a narrative that came into being long after it was a more everyman sport, or were people talking about that kind of thing at the time?
People were talking about it to an extent at the time. I wouldn't say that it came in long after. It came in maybe five or 10 years afterwards. So just to take the example of Argentina, the first team that wins the Argentine championship that's considered non-elite or non-Anglo wins in 1913. And by about 1920, you see this narrative of sort of a criollo soccer, that is a soccer that's based on the Latin roots of Argentina, as opposed to the Anglo, you know, the Anglo-Argentine community that had sort of won all the championships prior to that. So you get, you know, this uplifting of the sort of what were considered Latin traits, so the impulsiveness and the trickery and the guile and the improvisation, the individual play of the native-born players, as opposed to the sort of more stoic, rational and organized play of the English.
So this was a sort of athletic dramatization of the difference between us and why we're better.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
And also it plays an important, helps tell the story of race in Latin America. Talk about soccer, particularly in Honduras, I think.
Sure. I mean, in Honduras, what you have this sort of, again, in the 1920s, there's this search for the indigenous roots of Latin America. And in Honduras, what results is sort of the creation of a national myth of the nation being mestizo, that is being a mix between the indigenous and the European, and sort of writing out the Afro-Honduran past, right? So people of African descent had been in Honduras since the 1500s as slaves, and really had played a major role in the development of the colony and ultimately of the nation as well. But you get this this sort of, again, this writing out of the people of African descent, so that by the 2000s, officially roughly 2% of the population is African, or of African descent, excuse me. But in reality, it's probably somewhere around 10%. And this plays out on the soccer team, because you see, if you look at the national team now, roughly, I think, 60% or more of the team is of African descent. So it really allows you to look a little bit deeper at the questions of race in Honduras and at how the racial constructs are created.
Well, it's interesting what you discover or what you explain in the book is that the idea that Hondurans and others are trying to write out the role that slavery played in its own history. So to explain the presence and the dominance of African players, African Honduran players, there's a whole new narrative that gets told.
Exactly. And I think this is sort of one of the powers of soccer as a whole, is that it does have the ability to create narratives and recreate narratives. In the case of Honduras, you know, it allows you to look at sort of the social and political sort of access that Afro-Hondurans have or don't have. So really one of the only avenues out of poverty for Afro-Hondurans is to play soccer. And so they begin to play soccer in greater numbers. It also allows you to look deeper, I think, at how these, you know, why these narratives of negation are created.
Well, and what are the ratios now in terms of the percentage of population versus percentage of the national team?
So it's about, officially it's 2% of the Honduran population is of African descent. And 14 of the 23 players who are chosen for the national team to go to Brazil this year are of African descent.
So if you choose not to remember slavery as part of your past, then where do you say your players of African descent came from?
Right. So the narrative suggests that they come in the late 19th and early 20th century as part of the development of the banana industry along the north coast. So all of the, most of the Afro-Hondurans are, they say, sort of came from Jamaica or from the British Caribbean as part of this larger migration to work in the banana plantations.
So here's this game that everybody embraces and everybody knows about, that it plays a part in kind of retelling our story and sanitizing some of our past. But it's also interesting how this can then reinforce stereotype. I mean, if we go to the banana plantations just recently, I think there's a pretty good example of how this plays out in the field today.
Sure. Well, I mean, this is not necessarily related to Latin America. Well, it is actually, since Dani Alves is Brazilian. There's a Brazilian soccer player named Dani Alves who plays for Barcelona. And one of the ways that European fans sort of racially abuse players is by throwing bananas onto the field. Dani Alves, in a game just last week, there was a banana thrown onto the field while he was taking a corner kick, and he picked up the banana and ate it and then proceeded to take the corner kick.
This is appropriating our own story. But these kinds of coded racism then makes its way through the entire sport. So in Argentina, we talked earlier about this story that our Latin traits, mm-hmm. where our guile and our skill and our sort of wiliness is the thing that will trump these more formal British and European players. But this also plays out, reinforces a racist narrative as well.
Sure, it does. If you look at the case of Brazil, certainly the idea of football art, the sort of what we all think of as Brazilian style of football, which is, you know, fast flowing and sort of it's been said that Brazilians dance with the ball at their feet. This narrative actually is created in the 1930s by the anthropologist Gilberto Freire and the journalist Mario Fio, who basically write about the benefits of having African players in the side. But they say it in terms that today to our ears would sort of be quite racist, right? They say that the African blood of Brazil brings the irrationality. It brings the dance, the gait, the sort of musical play of soccer, and that's part of sort of a greater acceptance in one way of Afro-Brazilian culture at the time, right? Capoeira in the 1930s is also accepted as part of Brazilian culture, whereas prior to the 1930s, it's considered sort of a Afro-Brazilian criminal activity. The samba is also sort of highlighted as an element of Brazilian culture. And so this Afro-Brazilian soccer is brought to the fore at the same time as well.
It's a way of glorifying the qualities of people of African descent without really giving them full access
exactly.
to the culture. And,
exactly.
and you think you're saying nice things, but in fact you're making sure that the hierarchy remains in place.
Exactly. It is sort of a you know, it's taking the stereotypes of Afro-Brazilians and casting it in a positive light instead of in a negative light.
And if we thought that had no impact here in the United States, we only need to look to basketball and Donald Sterling.
Exactly.
But back to Latin America and soccer. What about women and women's involvement?
Sure. I mean, women have been involved in soccer since the 1880s, really. And they've been playing organized soccer, certainly in Chile. We know that there was organized soccer in the 1880s. But generally speaking, the sport's been suppressed. And this goes, the earliest sort of example of suppression in Latin America is from Brazil, where there are organized leagues in the 1930s of women's soccer. But by the 1940s, by the late 1930s, there's a great deal of concern over women playing soccer. There's a citizen, concerned citizen writes to the president of Brazil in 1940, saying that if women are allowed to play soccer, women's soccer teams will become, quote, destructive nuclei of the nation. And the reason that he suggests this will happen is that women will become masculinized. They will have less desire to have children. And also there's sort of public health literature at the time that suggests that women's soccer can cause cancer, that it can cause infertility, and that it can cause a depressive mentality among women.
Yeah. So as the 2014 World Cup approaches in Brazil, what do you keep in mind? What are you looking for?
What am I looking for? So for me, you know, I like to look at the way that soccer continues to sort of recraft narratives, right? So, you know, we're looking at, say, at the Honduran team and looking at how Afro-Hondurans continue to reconstruct ideas of Honduras. I also look at sort of Argentina, which, you know, has been criticized as a team that all plays overseas. The Argentines don't necessarily feel that they play with an Argentine style, which is, you know, relatively false. And I look for I look for Brazil to do quite well, and Argentina as well.
You a soccer fan?
Very big, yeah.
And I should probably point out that 1969 soccer war, it is true that it was riots and over a particular soccer match that was the proximate cause. But in fact, there were many underlying tensions. And I think it just goes to show that the fact that I can use soccer as a cover to launch a war talks about the importance of soccer in the political and social fabric.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it can be used to explain, you know, everything from race to gender to social class to international politics.
It's great reading. Thanks, Joshua. Good to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Joshua Nadel, author of Football, F-U-T-B-O-L, Football, Why Soccer Matters in Latin America, also a professor of Latin American and Caribbean History at North Carolina Central University. Going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill Monday, May 12th, 7 o'clock. Also Barnes & Noble at South Point June 10th and at the Regulator in Durham on June 11th. If you didn't get that, you can find it on our website, stateofthings.org. Thanks for listening. This is The State of Things. It's produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, and Anita Rao. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.